It's Central Time. I'm John Munson in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. The new coronavirus has resulted in major changes to a lot of things in our lives, including the way we worship. We talk with Milwaukee Archbishop Jerome Listecki about what the outbreak has meant for the Catholic Church and other religious institutions in Wisconsin. First, public health measures taken to slow the spread of the novel coronavirus have already had a big impact on the national and global economy. The latest numbers from the government show unemployment claims for the week ending on March 21st reached 3.3 million, a record high. Many businesses remain closed, and the global trade market is also taking a hit. The government is hoping to offset some of those problems with its latest stimulus bill, which puts $500 billion toward boosting affected industries and sends out direct checks of $1,200 to many Americans. Those are slated to come out in the next several weeks. To check up on the economy and the federal response, we're joined by Menzie Chin. He's a professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison. Menzie, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
The economic impact of this coronavirus is starting to take shape. Many of us might know someone who's lost a job or a business that's closed. Can you put the current situation into context for us? How serious is this for the economy?
Well, I think in terms of just the drop-off in economic activity and the pace at which the drop-off has occurred, this is unprecedented. It certainly has been much more rapid than what occurred during the last Great Recession, as we called it. So much more rapid, not really anything that warned you in terms of economic activity that something was coming. In addition, the sort of new unemployment insurance claims that occurred that were released last week for the previous week, well, that was unprecedented. There has never been a spike like that, and it's likely that the report that comes out this week will be even larger. But I will point out, you know, this is in some ways the thing that you want to happen. When you have an epidemic, you want to, in some ways, you don't want to reduce economic activity, but you want to reduce the things that are surrounding economic activity so that you don't have further propagation of the virus, or at least you slow down the propagation of the virus.
President Trump has said he wants to ease some of the social distancing guidelines and open up the economy. Others say for the sake of public health, as you just pointed out, things need to stay closed down for longer. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell addressed that in an interview last Thursday. Here's a listen.
I think the sooner we get the spread of the virus under control, people will regain confidence. When they become confident that is the case, then they will very willingly open their businesses up, go back to work. The consumer will be spending. So I think the first order of business will be to get the spread of the virus under control and then resume economic activity.
How are you looking at that back and forth between the economy and public health?
Well, I think the weight of evidence and expert advice is certainly on Chairman Powell's position. I think there's a false choice that's being put out there, as if you could reopen the economy quickly and restart economic activity without having the virus burst out and perhaps infect many, many more people, so that the longer-term impact on the economy is actually more negative. So we have that result from a series of simulations of various models that have to combine both epidemic-related research and economic research. And in addition, there's been recently a working paper that's been distributed. It's got lots of attention, which points out that in the 1918 flu, what happened was that the cities and states that implemented more vigorously and earlier these measures to prevent transmission of the virus actually, in the end, recovered better and had higher output over the longer term. So I think, you know, it's clearly a mistake to say, oh, we can just, you know, let people resume operations and nothing else will happen. The pace at which the virus infects people and then the resulting strain on the medical infrastructure, that is a function of what you do with respect to, you know, measures to prevent the mitigation of the spread.
You referenced the unemployment numbers, which the numbers seem quite, well, they're staggering. It's the highest number since records started being kept in 1967. Who's being hit the hardest?
Well, I think it's hard to say who exactly. I mean, anything, essentially, first of all, anybody who's in office where you want to do the social distancing and working from home, but you can't, they're going to be impacted. Manufacturing enterprises are closed down to a certain extent. So there are essential services that have to keep on going, or at least services and activities that have been deemed essential. So they're not being hit right away. But there's a lot of voluntary shutdowns of operations. Then that was the first round. What's going to happen over time is that people are not going to be consuming as much. For sure, services have been hard hit, you know, restaurants and so forth. So they are the first line. But over time, people are going to have less income despite the measures undertaken by the government. And what's going to happen then is consumption will decline. And if there's no demand for goods, then once again, you'll have more people losing their jobs.
We're talking with Menzi Qin, Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison, about the economic impact of the coronavirus. Those unemployment numbers, do they include people in the so-called gig economy, freelancers, artists, those kind of workers?
Well, now, I don't believe that they do. So on this count, I'm not sure. What I do know is that the bill that was passed should, in principle, address their concerns. That is, typically we can funnel money to people who are unemployed via the unemployment insurance system. Traditionally, gig workers have not been in that unemployment insurance system, but we're supposed to put into place some way of funneling income or resources to those workers. So the bill that was passed last week, that takes into account the fact that there are many people who are not covered by the unemployment insurance system as it is now. In addition, you know, we've extended beyond the usual time the amount of time that's covered, as well as the amount of funds that are given out. Whether that's going to be sufficient to offset all the negative impacts that we're seeing from this pandemic, that's unclear.
Individual checks for that as part of that package that was passed by Congress, $1,200 for people making less than $75,000 a year, given that this new reality could last for at least a few more months. How much is that really going to help?
Well, that's the short term, and I think we're feeling our way through in terms of what's going to have to happen over the longer term. You're right. $1,200 per person, $2,400 for a married couple. And then you've got the $500 per child. And by the way, that phases out after a certain income level. So it's unclear if that's anything more than a small buffer. But combined with the unemployment insurance, we're on our way to something that's going to help for a while. Could we do better? I'm sure we could have done better in this bill. There are things that are not covered. For instance, food stamps weren't enhanced. But that just means that we're going to have to likely do more in the coming months to make sure the economy just doesn't completely fall off a cliff. But let me remind you, I mean, in some ways, we can't restart economic activity, can't start making things and so forth, and just resuming business as normal. That's not a choice. If we try to do that at a point that's too early, before we've got things sort of stabilized and we have a means of tracking the infections in the economy, then we'll just be in a worse situation some months down the line.
We're talking to Menzi Qin, Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison, about the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic and how the government is responding. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about how this pandemic is affecting the economy and how it might recover? Has this already affected you personally? What do you want to see the government doing to help? Do you worry about the length of time that some parts of the economy will be shut down? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Menzi Qin, Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison, taking a look at the economic impact of COVID-19. And we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Have you already felt the financial impact of this pandemic? Do you think the government is doing a good job of responding to it? What else would you like to see happen? Have a question for Menzie Chin about how this is affecting the national and international economy? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email. The address is ideas@wpr.org. We've talked about some of the impacts here in the United States and unemployment and so forth. What about the international economy? What's happening there?
Well, we have sort of a ruling version of what's happening in the U.S. So in many countries, particularly in Europe, they're already hard hit. Obviously, we've all heard about the dire straits that Italy's in. And we expect to see increase in cases and so forth in the rest of Europe. What's interesting is that in parts of Asia, they managed to get things under control through implementation of stringent measures, you know, social distancing, lockdowns, and so forth, pretty early on. On the other hand, we've had instances where then those measures were relaxed, perhaps too early, and then you've had a resurgence. So Hong Kong is an instance where we thought, you know, they'd succeeded pretty much in controlling the epidemic. They eased up, and then now they have, once again, a problem. That just gives light to this issue about you don't want to sort of relax the constraints too early. Well, one of the impacts is that now we're going to have likely a worldwide recession, and that means that there'll be less demand for the things we make. And as a consequence, that's another hit to the U.S. economy. Even after the immediate effects of the pandemic dissipate, let's say, then what's true is demand is going to be reduced, and that's going to hurt our export industries.
Let's take a call. We have Michelle joining us from McFarland. Michelle, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I currently work three jobs. My full-time job is in the healthcare insurance, and it barely pays my other bills, miscellaneous bills, you know, electricity and tuition and so on. So that's why I chose to work the two or three jobs in the service industry as a bartender and in catering. Those two jobs, I make more than my first job. So now I've lost those two jobs, but I can't file unemployment. And I get that $1,200 check plus the $500. There's like nothing out for people like me to get that extra income or get anything in. So I'm stuck with the $1,200.
And Menzie, what about Michelle's situation? A lot of people in that same spot.
Well, I feel really bad about the situation that people are in that are similar to this situation here. I guess all I can say at the moment is that what this highlights is the problems systemically that occurred in the U.S. economy. In general, you would probably want people to be able to sustain themselves on one job that was full-time and paid sufficiently. But for a long time, what's been true is that too many people have had to rely on cobbling together a number of jobs because the salaries and wages weren't sufficient. And it's also the case that, for instance, the healthcare system in the U.S., it seemed like it was operating to a certain extent until the crisis hit, and then you see the shortcomings, the fact that many people are not covered. So it's not clear to me that there's a way within the current system to address these concerns directly, but it does highlight the fact that if we want to make the system more resilient over time, then these are issues that have to be addressed. That is, how do you get the income distribution to be better, more equally weighted so that people can sustain themselves without having to do a multiplicity of jobs, including jobs that are not covered by any sort of unemployment insurance or any sort of backstop.
The people may have noticed that gasoline prices are lower than we thought we'd ever see them again. What's going on here? Is this pandemic related, or are there other things at play here?
I think the way to think about it is there was a sort of in the background weakening demand for oil. But what happened is that with the shutdown in China, remember China was the first to implement a sort of almost nationwide lockdown, certainly a complete lockdown in Hubei province. What happened is that if you're not making things, then you don't need as much oil to power things and to transport things. China is a big marginal demander of oil on international markets. Take China offline, then, you know, it's supply and demand with what we call inelastic supply and demand curves. That is, they're pretty steep. So you have a big drop in the price of oil. And that feeds pretty quickly into a drop in the price of gasoline. So, yes, that's really the proximate cause is the pandemic. And that's good news for American consumers to the extent that we're actually consuming gasoline. On the other hand, it's bad news for parts of the U.S. where we are producing oil at the moment.
And the losses we're seeing in the economy now tied to the COVID-19 pandemic, when this eventually passes, does that mean it's going to be easier for the economy to bounce back?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of pent-up demand. People will want to get out. They'll want, you know, after being cooped up, they'll want to spend once there's a resolution to the uncertainty about where the economy is going. On the other hand, you know, the people's savings are going to be depleted. People will have built up debt. And, you know, there's going to be a whole bunch of relationships that were destroyed, you know, business-to-business, business-to-customer relationships that disappeared during this crisis, depending upon how long the crisis continues. So to me, it's not likely that we're going to be back to normal in terms of economic activity really soon. There'll be some bounce back when, depends upon how this crisis is managed, both in the public health and economic domains, but I don't anticipate we'll be quickly back at where we were before the epidemic.
Well, we all know that in order to buy things, people have to have money, and in order to have money, they have to have jobs. So, is this a chicken and egg kind of situation then?
To some extent, and that's why we have to. I mean, we're stuck in a quandary, and so who can step in? It's the federal government. You know, there's always a likening of people to governments. You know, if times are tough, tighten your belt. But there's one difference between you and me and the federal government, and that is the federal government can essentially borrow at close to zero interest rates, whereas you and I, well, we can't.
And I can't borrow whenever I want. But thank you so much. Really appreciate your time. Menzie Chin, for joining us. He's a professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison. He joined us for a look at the impact of COVID-19 on the economy and what the government is doing to offset it. Last month, before social isolation changed the way campaigns operate in Wisconsin, people were going door to door trying to turn out the vote, not only now, but for the November election. That was especially true in Milwaukee's African-American neighborhoods, where many voters stayed home in 2016. Those voters could be crucial to winning Wisconsin this year. Corrine Hess has this report.
It's a recent morning at Rise and Grind Cafe in Milwaukee's Bronzeville neighborhood. Soft rock hits from the 1980s are playing on the radio. And the coffee shop's regulars are enjoying breakfast. Corey Strong does odd jobs at the cafe. Born and raised in Milwaukee, Strong was a college history major and loves sharing odd facts about the city's first mayors and local politics. Strong was a political junkie for a long time, voting twice for President Barack Obama. Disinterest kept him from voting in 2016, but Strong says he's interested now.
I disagree with the president we got in so much that I want to see a change. So if that means voting for a Democrat or a person with ideas that's similar to mine, but not so much mine, but far left of what right is, I would do that.
Wisconsin's voter turnout in 2016 was the lowest it had been for a presidential election in nearly 20 years, and African-American wards reported some of the biggest declines. Democrats have vowed to focus on Milwaukee turnout this year, but Republicans are also making overt appeals to Wisconsin's African-American voters. In February, the Republican Party of Wisconsin opened its first field office in Bronzeville, a predominantly black neighborhood just north of downtown Milwaukee. Within 2 weeks, the office was vandalized. Just 5 blocks away at Rise and Grind, Strong and others question the motive of the GOP's office location.
I think that's a bad location. That's Bronzeville. That's a very... My grandparents moved up here in 1949 from Memphis, Tennessee.
Latrina Highwater is the owner of Rise and Grind. She says the fact that the GOP opened an office in this neighborhood lets her know that African Americans have power in this election.
The fact that they have it on King Drive, where I'm sure they know a lot of people are Democrats and they don't have our support, but that's a pretty bold move.
Mark Jefferson heads the Wisconsin GOP. He knows the party has done a poor job of reaching out to minorities, particularly African Americans.
I don't sit here and say we're going to necessarily win in the city of Milwaukee this time around, but if we get more votes out of that area than we have in the past, we will be making improvements that are going to be needed to win this state.
The state Democratic Party says it's been organizing in Milwaukee since after the 2016 election. And another Democratic group, Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, has also been on the ground. Rick Banks is the political director for BLOC. He says getting people to believe their voice matters has been difficult.
People feeling like they didn't have power and that no matter who they vote for, things aren't going to change. So for us, we changed that to say, like, the power rests with us and, like, we have to fight for and hold the people accountable for the things that that we want to see.
Despite all of the efforts of both Democrats and Republicans, there are still some people who don't believe their vote matters. Cartier Scott is a Black man living in Milwaukee. He says he votes in every local election, but after voting for Obama in 2008, he has not voted for president. In November 2012, Scott drove to his polling place and former elementary school, Bruce Elementary, on Milwaukee's northwest side.
Yeah, I remember sitting there and I was like, do I really want to vote? Yeah, I want to vote, but it's like, okay, I'm going to vote. Like, does my vote really count? Like, I was kind of, you know, in that realm.
Scott says he sat in the car for about 15 minutes, and then he drove off. He's not sure if he'll vote in this election. He'll decide closer to November. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk with Archbishop Jerome Lestecky from the Archdiocese of Milwaukee about the challenges and opportunities COVID-19 has brought to churches around the state. That's all coming up on Central Time. I'm John Munson in for Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm John Munson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, new reporting finds that Walmart almost faced criminal charges in 2018 over how it filled opioid prescriptions, until top officials at the Justice Department halted the investigation. We'll talk with the reporter who broke the story. First, worshipers around the state had to pray from home over the weekend. Under Governor Evers' Safer at Home order, places of worship can still hold services, but there can't be more than 10 people in attendance, and social distancing requirements have to be followed. The order went into effect last week. It's designed to limit the spread of COVID-19. The outbreak comes as we approach the holiest time of the year for Christians. In fact, our next guest, Milwaukee Archbishop Jerome Lestecky, has canceled Holy Week and Easter Masses. They're going to be live streamed instead. Many churches, mosques, and synagogues have been moving their services online and finding new ways to keep their communities connected. Archbishop Lestecky, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much, John. Thanks.
How difficult a time has this been for the Catholic Church and other religious institutions?
Well, I think very difficult. It's a an optic that we almost could never have envisioned, in the sense that when there's a crisis, one of the things that you want to do is you want to make sure the doors of your churches, the mosques, the synagogues are open so that people can gather together and take a tremendous amount of solace from one another. But because of the nature of the virus, the coronavirus, and its contagion, that you're almost endangering those people that you want to bring comfort to. The other aspect I would say is it takes a toll on religious leaders. Religious leaders, by their very nature, want to reach out to their people and to offer that type of comfort. So now religious leaders have to find other ways to extend that comfort. It's not going to be the same, because as we all know, even when you're approaching anything in the world of communication, that the first and the most primary way of communicating is face-to-face, faccio a faccio. And when that's taken away, an essential element of comfort is taken away for many people.
And then, you know, this is happening during Lent. Does that make things even more difficult?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's certainly for us, it's but it's always an aspect. I would say with the over 1.2 million Catholics in Wisconsin and over 600,000 in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, we have 196 parishes. We don't have a parish that has a celebration that's less, a Sunday celebration that's less than 150, 200 people, and those are the small ones. So when you think about that, we have to in some way envision and abide by that, and help people to understand that although their longing is to be there, their zeal is to be there for God, to testify and to witness to their, it's a matter of understanding that your care for your brothers and sisters is important, is equally important at this time, and that care has to be observed. And so we call upon our priests, you know, our pastors, to observe those good restrictions that help people and help us to curb this pandemic.
Well, and then there are all the other events that revolve around churches, things like weddings, baptisms, reconciliation, Bible studies, all of those things that we're used to seeing happen that just aren't happening now.
Not to mention fish fries, which is a big thing for us all throughout the year here in Wisconsin, but also especially during Lenten seasons when we have observances of abstinence from meat, and they become an aspect. The other thing that many people fail to realize is that the parishes, are units of social community gathering. So besides just the religious aspect of it, there are so many gatherings of groups, of Knights of Columbus, of Our Ladies. In fact, we were ready to have a Men of Christ conference that I was going to be, and that's 3,000 men come in to the Milwaukee Theater. 3,000 men coming in, and that all had to be canceled because of our care and our concern for others. And these are aspects that bring a lot of strength, personal strength, to individuals. But we convey the fact that we have to understand that at this moment it calls for basically a different response, and as good citizens, we have to go shoulder to shoulder, arm in arm with our brothers and sisters to make sure that we're attacking this pandemic the way it should be.
Jerome Listecki is the Archbishop of the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. We're talking about how this COVID-19 pandemic is affecting our religious life, our spiritual life. One of the things that we haven't mentioned yet is funerals. We talked about weddings and that sort of thing. What about funerals? You've asked for funerals to be delayed if possible. What do you say to people who've recently lost a loved one and have no idea of when they'll be able to hold a service?
We put on that same restrictions that are put on for all services, that we will go ahead with a funeral service if the congregants can be less than 10. Now, for most of us, we know that that's almost impossible, because many individuals, just immediate families, will have more than 10. But we do that because this is something that we know has to be done. However, we will do the rites of the Christian burial. We will do that if it can be maintained under 10. However, what we will do is we will do that type of restricted service with a promise to do a memorial service at a later date when the restrictions are off, so that we can celebrate. For instance, I recently celebrated a funeral mass for Father Alan Summers. Father Alan Summers, a priest of multiple years, many years in the Archdiocese, and I can tell you that when a priest passes on, people from all of the various parishes will come. You'll have as many as 300-400 people at a priest's funeral, and that's just an average amount. Well, we had less than 10 at this at his funeral. We had his cousins, and then just those, myself, and those immediately who were celebrating basically the funeral rites. And it was, I can tell you, John, it was very strange. It was strange for me because this is not the norm. This is not the way it is. However, it was so dignified. It was so well done that I almost could hear Alan saying, of course, we've got to do this for the sake of our people. For the sake of our people, we do this. So there is a sense that people understand. They know that this is exceptional. This is not something we normally would do, and they know that that our pledge and our promise to offer a time to memorialize that life at a later date will take place.
Considering the changes you've made, has there been any pushback? How people reacted to what you're doing?
Sure, there's been pushback. I mean, I don't expect any leader at any given time to make a decision and not have pushback. I mean, you're a broadcaster. You know that when you offer opinion, 100% of the people agree with you on your opinion. Of course not. So therefore, there's pushback, and the type of pushback varies. Some people who think that we shouldn't do anything, we should just keep the churches open, and we should continue to do, and we should just allow whatever happens to happen. And then there is those that want to be more restrictive, to say we shouldn't do anything. Well, we have to find and listen to those people who are. Those individuals who are people of medicine, of science. We have people on the front line. We have doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals, treating people, going to work, not knowing whether they're going to be subjected to being a carrier of the coronavirus. They will do everything that they can, and they know that they themselves are endangering themselves in relationship to their families. They're on the front line. We've got to acknowledge it. We've got to do things to support and to help them. So during that period of time, I call upon all of our people that we can, people of faith, we can do something. And you know what that something is? We can pray. We're believers, so we can pray. We can ask God's intervention. We can pray for the protection of those people who are offering their lives on the front lines, and we can pray, and we can pray for an end of it. But what are we learning from this? We're learning that we're really a people who are tied together. There's a solidarity among us, and that solidarity has to be expressed in the way we react to this at this time.
Archbishop Listecki, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome, John. Thank you, and thank you to your listeners.
Jerome Listecki is the Archbishop of the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. We talked with him about how the coronavirus has affected the Catholic Church and other religious denominations in Wisconsin. Listecki recently canceled all public Holy Week and Easter Masses. Instead, those services will be live-streamed from the Cathedral of St. John the Evangelist in downtown Milwaukee. Coming up, we'll find out how Walmart's handling of opioid prescriptions almost led to criminal charges and why the investigation was shut down. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm John Munson. Coming up, life under coronavirus is starting to set in, and some scammers are exploiting their crisis to make money. No surprise there. We'll talk about how to spot those scams and how you can protect yourself. First, federal prosecutors were planning to bring criminal charges against Walmart in 2018 over the company's handling of suspicious opioid prescriptions. at least until top appointees at the Justice Department stepped in. That's according to new reporting from ProPublica, which tracks the years-long investigation and Walmart's efforts to get the potential indictment shut down. All of that was happening as the country was seeing a record number of deaths due to opioid overdoses. Jesse Eisinger is a senior reporter and editor with ProPublica. Jesse, thanks for joining us on Central Time.
John, thanks for having me. I just want to say I grew up in Madison, so I'm always happy to come back to the Badger Land and talk about my work.
Well, we're glad that you were able to be with us today. This case started in Texas in 2016. Talk about how the investigators first got keyed into Walmart's pharmaceutical practices and what they found.
So they were tracking some pill mill doctors, two pretty bad doctors in Texas, the DEA and federal prosecutors in the Eastern District of Texas. And they tracked three women who left the office of one of these doctors, drove a long way, about 60 miles, to a Walmart in McKinney, Texas, and then walked out, all three of them, with huge prescriptions for really suspicious opioids. And they were, unfortunately, they were they had dependence problems on painkillers, those three women. And the prosecutor, a woman named Heather Rattan, she was a 20-year veteran of the Eastern District, and she had a lot of experience with drug cartels. And she basically said to the DEA agents and to her fellow prosecutors, well, we're going to do the same thing we do in a heroin investigation. We're going to try to focus on the source and cut off the source. And one of those sources was Walmart, and they began investigating Walmart's pharmacy practices.
Pharmacists were raising concerns. Walmart pharmacists were raising concerns about some of the prescriptions they were getting. What kind of feedback did they get from the company when they put up those red flags?
Exactly. So this is what the DEA and the Eastern District of Texas prosecutors found was when they got discovery from Walmart, what they found was, excuse me, not discovery, Walmart turned over some emails. What they found was that pharmacists were raising alarms about having to fill prescriptions to various doctors. And they weren't just in Texas. It was a nationwide problem. There was one Florida doctor who was sending patients from Kentucky to central Wisconsin, actually, as it happens, to get their prescriptions filled, their opioid prescriptions filled. And this doctor was sending patients to over 30 states to Walmarts in over 30 states. This is a nationwide problem. So what they were finding was that when these pharmacists were raising alarms saying, this is a liability on us, we shouldn't be filling these prescriptions are not for legitimate medical purposes, compliance department in Bentonville, in headquarters, at the home office, they were basically turning a blind eye. That's what the prosecutors ended up believing. They were saying things like, well, you can't block these doctors. You can't just, you have to evaluate prescriptions on a prescription by prescription, case by case basis, which was a kind of bureaucratic hurdle. And one of them, actually, one compliance officer actually said to a sales manager, Walmart people should be focused on, quote, driving sales. That was what he actually put in an email that prosecutors thought was very damaging, very damning.
Jesse Eisinger is a senior reporter and editor with ProPublica. We're talking about the case of the U.S. attorneys against Walmart and what all happened with this concerning some suspicious opioid prescriptions. I gather from your reporting that criminally indicting an entire company is a rare move, but in this case, the prosecutors felt that's where the evidence led them. How rare is this? And what happened once they started moving on this?
Yeah, so it's almost unheard of to prosecute a Fortune 500 company. It almost never happens to indict companies. Prosecutors are really reluctant to do that because it affects the employees, and it can sometimes put a company out of business. So they've really shied away from that. In fact, I think they've shied away too much from that. I wrote a book about this called The Chicken Leap Club. I won't say it on the radio. Why the Justice Department fails to prosecute executives. And here they wanted to prosecute the company, and they had to go through the higher echelons of the Department of Justice, and Trump appointees at the Department of Justice said no. They nixed it. They said you cannot prosecute. They overruled the determination from the Eastern District of Texas. Now, you have to understand, the Eastern District of Texas prosecutors, they're not, liberals from the Northeast or something. The U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Texas himself was a Trump appointee, a Republican. So these guys were not kind of socialists by any means, but they were overruled by the Trump appointees. When they wanted to prosecute an individual, the compliance manager who said that people should be focused on driving sales, they nixed that as well, and then they put up subsequent roadblocks for the civil settlement, all to the enormous frustration of the prosecutors in the Eastern District of Texas.
And the attorneys representing Walmart in this whole thing were both, I understand the two lead attorneys, were both former federal prosecutors themselves. How did that play into this?
Well, they had enormous amount of influence and pull. They could get access. One was an outside attorney for Jones Day, which is a very influential law firm. She was a former U.S. attorney in California. And Jones Day is particularly influential in the Trump administration. One was the former U.S. attorney in where Bentonville is located in Arkansas. So he had overseen Walmart and then went through the revolving door to become an in-house attorney at Walmart. And they were able to reach to the top echelons of the Department of Justice. They wrote to many officials in the higher-ups at the DOJ, including Rod Rosenstein, who then was the deputy attorney general, famous for his oversight of the Mueller investigation. And at one point, the prosecutors had a meeting with Rod Rosenstein. Rosenstein's office had already told them that they could not have bring the criminal charges against the company. And the DEA administrator said, a fine is not going to be enough for these guys. These guys have more money than they know what to do with. And Rosenstein rebuked him or made a joke saying, well, not that there's anything wrong with making money. We're all capitalists here. And the Eastern District prosecutors and the DEA agents and people listening were really taken aback by Rosenstein's quip, because I think they thought, well, you're implying that we're trying to punish this company for making money, for being successful. We're trying to punish them because we believe that they committed crimes.
And what's Walmart's position been in this? What have they said about this whole case? What were their tactics?
Well, Walmart has consistently argued that no one at the company committed crimes, and therefore the corporation also is not liable criminally. They've kind of opened the door for civil liability. They've admitted some mistakes here. But their tactic has been, it's a playbook that many companies use to great effect, which is to go over the heads of prosecutors where they don't like the answer they're getting from the line prosecutors, from the staff prosecutors, from the DEA agents, or in some cases the FBI. They go over the heads and they go to the political appointees. And this actually worked in the Obama administration as well to great effect, to blunt investigations and dull them. But it's working even better in the Trump administration. They go and they say, these prosecutors are out of control. One of the things that Walmart really did, which is kind of very Trumpian, is to attack the investigators. So they really went on the offensive here. And they said, the Eastern District of Texas, they're unethical, they're out of control, you have to rein them in. And that seems to have been very effective with Trump appointees at the DOJ in Washington.
And this one of the prosecutors in this case actually resigned over all this, didn't he?
Yes. Well, the head of the civil division of the Eastern District of Texas was so frustrated that he resigned. He tendered his resignation in the fall of 2019, just a few months ago, after he had complained. One of the things he complained about was that Walmart wasn't cooperating with its subpoena. You know, a subpoena is a lawful document, you're supposed to comply with it. And Walmart basically was treating it as optional and picking and choosing what it wanted to give.
And we've seen that happen before. Jesse Eisinger, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today. Jesse Eisinger is a senior reporter and editor with ProPublica. He talked with us about his reporting about Walmart's situation and how it was handled. More of us are working at home these days, thanks to the COVID-19 pandemic, and we're still adjusting to the differences between our office and our home. A new survey asked people how working from home differs from the traditional office environment. Among the survey results, many felt that in video conferences, their opinions weren't heard or that their contributions weren't acknowledged like they would be during a face-to-face meeting. Their survey also asked whether we leave our cameras on or off during meetings. Well, the survey of stay-at-home workers found that 44% of respondents said that they dressed in professional attire, specifically for video meetings. 16% said that they had rearranged their homes to look more professional in the background. 11% reported seeing something they considered unprofessional in the background of a video call, and this might include something like your naked spouse running through the room trying to get a bath towel. 12% said they leave their cameras off during video conferences because they're either naked or only partially clothed. All of this begs the question, which are you? Are you part of the 44% or the 12%? How do you dress for video calls? T-shirt and sweats, bathrobe, office casual, suit and tie? Or do we just not want to go there? Working from home, what a learning experience this has been. As for me, I leave the camera and my clothes on.